Mystery Club. Chapter 71. Do you need a hand to get down into the grave? Asks Ibrahim. Yes, please, says Austin, that would be terribly kind of you. Bogdan has borrowed an arc light and it is trained on the grave he had opened on the morning that Ian Ventham was murdered. The grave that had revealed an extra occupant on top of the coffin. A skeleton, buried where it had no right to be buried. Austin holds onto Ibrahim's arm and takes a step down into the grave. He is careful not to step on the bones scattered on the lip of the coffin. He looks up at Elizabeth and chuckles. This takes me back, Lizzie. Remember Leipzig? Elizabeth smiles, she certainly does remember. Joyce also smiles, because she has never heard Elizabeth called Lizzie before. She wonders if the others caught it. What do you think, Prof? Asks Ron, sitting happily at the feet of our Lord Jesus Christ, and drinking from a can of Stella. Well, I wouldn't ordinarily like to say, replies Austin, raising his glasses to get a closer look at the femur he is now holding, but if I were a gossip, among friends, of course, I would say these have been down here some while. Some while, Austin? Asks Elizabeth. I would say so, considers Austin. Just by the coloration. And if you were being more specific, asks Elizabeth. Well, goodness, says Austin. If you want me to be specific, I would say, he takes a moment to calibrate his thoughts. I would say really quite some while indeed. So they could have been buried at the same time as Sister Margaret, asks Joyce. What's the date on the headstone? Asks Austin. 1874, reads Joyce. Not a chance. 30, 40, 50 years perhaps, depending on the soil, but not 150. So at some point, says Ibrahim, somebody has dug up this grave, buried another body in it and then filled it in again. Certainly, agrees Austin. You have yourselves a mystery. Another nun, perhaps, Austin, asks Elizabeth. Any jewelry down there? Any fragments of clothing? Not a thing on this one, says Austin. Stripped bare. If it was murder, then someone knew what they were doing. I'm going to take a few bones with me, if you don't mind. I'll have a little look at them in the morning, just to give you a clearer picture. Absolutely, Austin, take your pick. Says Elizabeth. Bogdan blows out his cheeks. So we got to tell police now. Oh, I think we can probably keep this to ourselves until Austin gets back to us, replies Elizabeth. If everyone agrees. Everyone agrees. Someone give me a hand out of the grave, says Austin. Bogdan, old chap. Bogdan nods, but seems to want to get something clear first. Listen, I just need to say one thing. Is okay? In case maybe I go mad. This is not normal. Right? An old man in a grave looking at bones. Someone is murdered maybe, but no one tells the police. Bogdan, you didn't tell the police when you first dug up the bones, says Joyce. Yes, but I am me, says Bogdan. I'm not normal. Well, we're us, says Joyce, and we're not normal either. Although I did used to be. Normal is an illusory concept, Bogdan, adds Ibrahim. Bogdan, trust us, says Elizabeth. We just want to find out whose these remains might be and who buried them, and that will be a lot easier without the police poking their noses in until absolutely necessary. If the police have the bones first, you can bet that will be the last we hear about them. And that seems unfair, after all our hard work. I trust you, says Bogdan, then screws up his face as a thought occurs. Though if it goes wrong I bet it's me sent to prison. I won't let that happen, you're too useful, says Elizabeth. Now, please help Austin out of the grave and grab those bones for me. I suggest we all go back to Joyce's for a nice cup of tea. Splendid, says Austin, placing his selection of bones on the lip of the grave before reaching out for Bogdan's arms. You lead the way, Lizzie, says Ron and finishes off his can of Stella. Chapter 72. Joyce, there was a jolly atmosphere, and I can understand the reasons why. We each of us understand we're in a gang and we understand we are in the middle of something unusual. We understand also, I think, that we are doing something illegal, but we are past the age of caring. Perhaps we are raging against the dying of the light, but that is poetry, not life. There will be other reasons I have missed out, but I know on the walk back down the hill we felt giddy. Like teenagers out too late. But when Austin laid the pile of bones on my dining table, while we still knew it was an adventure, I think they began to have a sobering effect on all of us. Even Ron. It is all very well, the Thursday Murder Club and all our derring do, and the freedom of age and whatever we like to tell ourselves. But someone had died, however long ago it might have happened, so it was right to pause for reflection. There was no way around it, we couldn't conjure a single good reason why the extra body was there. On closer inspection, fueled by orange drizzle cake, Nigella, Austin was fairly sure that the body was a man, so it wasn't a nun. But who was he? And who had killed him? The first step to finding out the answers would be to discover when he had been killed. 30 years ago? 50 years ago? There was a big difference. Austin explained he would take the bones away and do further tests. After everybody had left, I googled him and it turns out he is a sir. I can't say I was surprised, he really did know a great deal about bones. Quite what he made of standing in a grave, at 10 at night, in his 80s, is his business, but I suppose any friend of Elizabeth is probably used to these things. 3 sugars in his tea too, though you wouldn't know by looking at him. And then the biggest question of all, of course. You'll be ahead of me here. Had the motive been found for one much more recent murder? Did someone else know the bones were hidden there? Was Ian Ventham killed to protect the Garden of Eternal Rest and the secret of those bones? We talked for around an hour, I suppose. Were we right not to involve the police? We will have to tell them eventually, but the feeling was that this is our story, our graveyard, our home and, just for the time being, we wanted to keep it for ourselves. As soon as we get the results from Austin we will have to tell all, of course. So we are trying to solve 2 murders, and possibly 3, if the skeleton was murdered. Or, I should say, if the skeleton is of someone who was murdered. Is a skeleton a person? That's a question for greater minds than mine. I know Elizabeth is keen to track down Bobby and Johnny, but we all agreed the bones have to take precedence for now. I wonder if Chris and Donna are making any progress. We certainly haven't heard if they are. I do hope they're not keeping anything from us. Chapter 73. Chris and Donna are walking the 3 flights of stairs up to Chris's office. Donna has pretended to be frightened of lifts, to force Chris to walk. So, Jason Ritchie for the Tony Curran murder, says Chris. And Matthew Mackey for Ian Ventham. Unless we're missing something, says Donna. I wouldn't put that past us, says Chris. So, let's work it through. We know Matthew Mackey was there and we know he's a liar. He's a doctor, not a priest. So we know he could get hold of fentanyl and he'd know how to use it, says Donna. Agreed, says Chris. I think we've got everything except a motive. Well, he doesn't want the graveyard moved, says Donna. Is that enough? Not enough to arrest him. Unless we find out why he doesn't want it moved. Is impersonating a priest a crime? Asks Donna. Someone I met on Tinder once pretended he was a pilot and tried to grope me outside an all bar one. I bet he regretted that. I punched him in the balls, then called in his reg number and got him breathalyzed on the way home. They both smile. But the smiles are fleeting. Both know they are in danger of letting Matthew Mackey slip between their fingers. No evidence whatsoever. Have you heard anything from your pals in the Thursday Murder Club? Asks Chris. Not a peep, says Donna. which makes me nervous. Me too, says Chris. And I really don't want to be the one to tell them about Jason Ritchie. Chris pauses for a moment on the landing, pretending to think, but really just to catch his breath. Perhaps Mackie's got something buried in the graveyard, says Chris. Doesn't want it dug up. Good place to bury something, agrees Donna. Chapter 74. Joyce, have you ever used Skype?
I hadn't until this morning, and now I have.
Ibrahim set it up, and so we had gone round to his. He keeps his flat so clean, and I don't think he has anyone in to do it. There are files everywhere, but all locked away, so you can see them but not read them. Imagine the stories you must hear if you're a therapist. Who did what to who? Or is it, whom did what to who? Either way, I bet he's heard all sorts. Austin rang at 10 on the dot, as you would expect from a sir, and told us what he knew. We could see him on screen, and we took it in turns to go in the little box in the corner. It was hard, because the box is very small, but I expect you get used to it if you do it a few times. The body was a man, which he'd already told us. He had a gunshot wound to the femur. Austin held it up to show us. We all tried to get in the box for that bit. Had that been the wound that killed him? Austin wouldn't like to say for certain, but probably not. A pre-existing injury. At one point his wife walked past in the background. What must she think? Her husband holding up bones to a computer screen? Perhaps she is used to it. Now, how much do you know about how to tell how old bones are?
I knew nothing, and Austin went through the whole thing in detail. It was fascinating. There was a machine, and there was a special dye, and something to do with carbon.
I tried to remember this all the way home so I could write it down, but I'm afraid it's gone. But it was very interesting. He would be very good on the one show if they ever needed it. He'd taken some soil with him too, and done tests on that, but the soil stuff was less interesting. Back to the bones, please, I had been thinking. The long and short of it, though, is that Austin had done some maths, and you can't be certain, and there were variables, and no one has all the answers, and all he could really do was make his best guess. At this point Elizabeth told him to stop prattling on and get to it. Elizabeth can get away with that sort of thing, even to a sir. So he came out with it. The body was buried sometime in the 1970s, probably earlier rather than later. So 50-odd years ago, give or take. We thanked Austin, but then no one knew how to hang up. Ibrahim tried for a while and you could see he was losing face. In the end Austin's wife came to the rescue his end. She seems lovely. So there we had it. Two potential murders 50 years apart. Plenty to chew on for everyone there. And probably time to tell Chris and Donna what we have done. I hope they don't take it too personally. Elizabeth then asked if I would like to go to a crematorium in Brighton with her today, on a hunch, but I had already said that I would cook lunch for Bernard, so nothing doing. I know you can't smell it, but I'm making him steak and kidney. He is getting thin, so I'm just seeing what I can do. Chapter 75. Donna and Chris are waiting for their free coffee at the Wild Bean Cafe inside the BP garage on the A21. Anything to get out of the station for half an hour. To stop looking at the endless files from the Irish passport office. Chris picks up a chocolate bar.
Chris, you don't need that, says Donna.
Chris gives her a look.
Please, says Donna.
Let me help, I know it's hard. Chris nods and puts the chocolate bar back.
So, what's in it for Mackie, asks Donna.
What's the connection with the graveyard? Why protect it if he's not a priest?
Chris shrugs.
Perhaps it's just a way of getting to vent them. Perhaps there's another connection between them. Have we looked at Dr. Mackie's patient lists?
You never know.
Chris then picks up a cereal bar.
That's even worse than a chocolate bar, says Donna. Even more sugar. Chris puts it back down. He's going to be forced to eat a piece of fruit at this rate.
He's dodgy as hell, says Chris. All we're missing is his motive.
Donna's phone buzzes and she reads a message. She purses her lips and looks up at Chris.
It's Elizabeth. She wonders if we might like to pop over this evening.
I think that might have to wait, says Chris.
Tell her we're busy solving two murders.
Donna continues to scroll through the message. She says she has something for us.
I quote, please do not read another file until you have seen what we have found.
Also, there will be Sherry.
See you at 8.
Donna puts her phone in her pocket and looks at her boss.
Well, she asks.
Well.
Chris slowly strokes his stubble and considers the Thursday Murder Club.
He has to face it, he likes them.
He's happy drinking their tea, eating their cake and chatting off the record.
He likes their rolling hills and their big sky.
Was he being taken advantage of?
Well, almost certainly, but, for now, he was getting plenty in return.
Would this all look very bad if it came out?
Yes, but it won't.
And, if it did, why not just take Elizabeth into his disciplinary hearing and let her work her magic?
Eventually he looks up at Donna, who has her eyebrows raised waiting for an answer.
I'm a reluctant yes.
Chapter 76.
Now we can do this one of two ways, says Elizabeth.
You can kick up a fuss and curse us to the heavens and we can all waste a lot of time.
Or you can just accept what has happened and we can enjoy our sherry and get on with this.
Your choice.
Chris cannot speak for a moment.
He looks at the four of them.
Then to the air, then to the floor.
Looking for words that don't want to come.
He holds the flat of a palm in the air in front of him, in an effort to pause reality for the briefest of moments.
But no luck.
You, he begins, slowly, you, dug up a body.
Well, technically we didn't dig it up, says Ibrahim.
But a body was dug up,
yes, says Chris.
Elizabeth and Joyce nod.
Elizabeth takes a sip of her sherry.
That's the long and short of it, confirms Joyce.
And you then performed a forensic analysis on the bones.
Well, again, not us personally.
And only on some of them, says Ibrahim.
Oh, that's fine then.
Just a few.
Chris's voice is raised, and Donna realizes it's the first time she's experienced this.
Then I wish you all a good evening.
Nothing to see here.
I knew you'd get melodramatic, says Elizabeth.
Can we just get this over with and move on to business?
Donna steps in.
Melodramatic, she addresses Elizabeth directly.
Elizabeth, you just dug up a human body and failed to report it to the police.
This isn't pretending to be a nun who's had her bag stolen.
What nun? Asks Chris.
Nothing, says Donna quickly.
This is a serious crime.
Elizabeth, you could all go to jail for this.
Nonsense, says Elizabeth.
Far from nonsense, says Chris.
What on earth are you doing?
I need you to think very carefully about what you say next.
Why did you dig up a body?
Let's take this step by step.
Well, as I stated previously, we didn't dig up the body.
But our attention was drawn to the fact that a body had been dug up, says Ibrahim.
And we were curious, naturally, says Ron.
Our attention was grabbed, agrees Ibrahim.
What with the murder of Ian Ventham, adds Joyce, it seemed it might be important.
You didn't think Donna and me might have been interested at this point, asks Chris.
Firstly, Chris, it's Donna and I, says Elizabeth.
And secondly, who knew what the bones were?
We didn't want to waste your time until we knew for sure what we were dealing with.
What if we'd called you out and they were nothing but cow bones?
Wouldn't we have looked silly old fools then?
We wouldn't have wanted to waste your time, agrees Ibrahim.
We know you are busy with two murders already.
But off they went for analysis, continues Elizabeth.
And back it comes, human bones, good to have it confirmed, no cost to the taxpayer. Male, died sometime in the 1970s, a gunshot wound to the leg, but no way of telling if that's what killed him. Now to invite Chris and Donna to take a look, and to lead things from here. Get the professionals in. It really feels like you might be thanking us. Chris is trying to compose a response. Donna decides that this one might be her responsibility. Christ, Elizabeth, just give it a rest for 1 second. You can drop the act with us. The second you dug up that body, you knew they were human bones, because I think you can tell the difference. Joyce, you were a nurse for 40 years, do you know the difference between human bones and cow bones? Well, yes, admits Joyce. The second you did that, Elizabeth, you and your whole gang, we are not Elizabeth's gang, interrupts Ibrahim. Donna raises her eyebrows at Ibrahim, who holds up a hand in concession. She continues. The lot of you, from that moment, were in deep, deep trouble. This is not a neat little trick. You might fool the rest of the world, but you don't fool me. You're not plucky underdogs, or helpful amateurs. This is a serious crime. This is bigger than a serious crime. And this doesn't end with us all giggling over a glass of sherry. It ends in a courtroom. How could you be so stupid? The four of you. We're friends, and you treat me like this. Elizabeth sighs. Well, this is exactly what I meant, Donna. I knew you'd both make a fuss. A fuss, says Donna incredulously. Yes, a fuss, says Elizabeth. And I do understand, in the circumstances. Just doing your job, agrees Ron. Admirable, if you want my opinion, adds Ibrahim. But the fuss ends here, says Elizabeth. If you're going to arrest us, arrest us. Take the four of us to the station, question us all night. Get the same answer all night. No comment, says Ron. No comment, says Ibrahim. Like on 24 hours in police custody, says Joyce. You don't know who dug the body up and you won't hear the answer from any of us, continues Elizabeth. You don't know who took the bones away for analysis and you won't hear that from us either. At the end of the evening you might try and explain to the CPS that four people in their 70s and 80s have failed to report digging up a body. For what reason? With what evidence, other than the inadmissible confession you've taken from us this evening? And with four suspects, all of whom are quite happy to go to court, smile happily and pretend to mistake the judge for their granddaughter and ask why she doesn't visit often enough. The whole process is difficult, costly, and time-consuming, and achieves nothing. No one is going to prison, no one is getting a fine, no one's even going to be picking litter by the roadside. Not with my back, says Ron. Or, continues Elizabeth, you can forgive us, and believe us when we say we were trying to help. You can let us apologize for our overenthusiasm, because we did know what we were doing was wrong, but we did it anyway. We know you've spent the last 24 hours in the dark and we know we are in your debt. And if you forgive us, then tomorrow morning, on a wild hunch, you can order a search of the Garden of Eternal Rest. You can dig up the body, you can send it to your own forensics team, who will tell you it's a male who was almost certainly buried in the early 1970s, and then we'll all happily be on the same page. There is a moment's silence. So, asks Chris, very slowly, you've reburied the bones. We thought it was best, says Joyce. To give you the glory? I'd leave the grave in the top right-hand corner till about fourth or fifth, if I were you, says Ron. Don't want to make it too obvious. And in the meantime, continues Elizabeth, we can all have a nice evening and no more shouting. We can tell you everything we know. So you can really hit the ground running in the morning. You could even share a bit of information with us if you thought that was appropriate, adds Ibrahim. How about some information about the custodial sentences you can get for perverting the course of justice? Or disturbing a grave, says Chris. up to 10 years, if you're interested.
Oh, we just went through all this, Chris, sighs Elizabeth.
Stop grandstanding and swallow your pride.
And besides, we're not hampering, we're helping.
I didn't notice either of you digging up a body, adds Ron, to Chris and Donna.
We have certainly done an awful lot of the work so far, says Ibrahim.
So this is how I see it, confirms Elizabeth.
Either you arrest us, which we would all understand, and Joyce, in fact, I think would actually enjoy.
No comment, says Joyce, nodding happily.
Or you don't arrest us and we can spend the rest of the evening talking about exactly why someone buried a body, on this hillside, sometime in the 1970s.
Chris looks at Donna.
And we can also discuss whether that same person has just murdered Ian Ventham to keep it secret, says Elizabeth.
Donna looks at Chris.
Chris has a question.
So you think the same person might have committed two murders?
But nearly 50 years apart.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? Asks Elizabeth.
It's an interesting question we could have been asking last night, says Chris.
It might have been useful to know we could be looking out for someone who was right here in the 1970s and is still right here now, adds Donna.
We really are sorry, says Joyce.
But Elizabeth was adamant, and you know Elizabeth.
Let's move on, says Elizabeth.
Put this behind us.
Do we have a choice, Elizabeth? Asks Chris.
Choice is overrated, you'll learn that as the years fly by, says Elizabeth.
Now, to business.
What do you make of the priest, I wonder?
Father Mackey?
Might he have been around when this place was a convent?
I take it from that question that you haven't been able to find out anything about Father Mackey, says Chris.
Don't tell me I've found a chink in your armor.
My inquiries are ongoing, says Elizabeth.
No need, Elizabeth, we've cracked that one for you, says Donna.
It's Dr. Mackey.
Not a priest, never has been, never will be.
A doctor in Ireland, moved over here in the 90s.
That's very curious, says Elizabeth.
Why pretend to be a priest?
Told you he was a wrong un, says Ron to Ibrahim.
So, he might have killed Ian Ventham, says Donna.
And he's certainly up to something.
But I doubt it's because of your bones.
Is it worth my pointing out any more that this is all confidential, says Chris.
You are quite safe with us.
You know that, don't you?
Nothing ever leaves this room, says Elizabeth.
Shall we just forget this ever happened, the business with the bones and what have you, and pool our knowledge?
I think we've pooled quite enough for one day, Elizabeth, says Donna.
Oh really, says Elizabeth.
And yet, you haven't even told us about the Tony Curran photograph yet.
We had to find that out for ourselves.
Donna and Chris both look at Elizabeth.
Chris lets out a theatrical sigh.
By way of a peace offering, says Ibrahim, perhaps you would like to know who took the photograph.
Chris looks up to the heavens.
Or Joyce's Artex ceiling.
I would actually like to know that, yes.
Lad named Turkish Johnny, says Ron.
Although he's not Turkish, adds Joyce.
You've seen the photo, Ron, asks Donna.
Ron nods.
Nice one of Jason, eh?
You want my view, for what it's worth, says Ron.
You find Turkish Johnny or Bobby Tanner, you find Tony Curran's killer.
Well then, if we're laying all our cards on the table, says Chris, has Jason explained away his phone calls to Tony Curran on the morning of the murder?
And has he explained away the presence of his car in the area at the exact moment that Tony Curran was murdered?
Yes, says Elizabeth.
To our satisfaction.
Anything you'd like to share, asks Donna.
Listen, I'll get him to give you a bell and explain, don't worry, says Ron.
But shall we get on and find this Johnny fella and Bobby Tanner?
Just leave that with us, please, says Chris.
I think we're unlikely to just leave that with you, Chris, says Elizabeth. I'm ever so sorry. Would you like some sherry? Asks Joyce. It's only Sainsbury's, but it's taste the difference. Chris sinks back into his chair and submits. If any of this ever gets back to my superintendent, I will personally arrest you and march you into court myself. I swear, on my life. Chris, no one will ever find out, says Elizabeth. You know how I used to make my living.
Well, not really, if I'm honest.
Exactly. As a complicit silence falls over the room, it seems the evening's drinking can now begin in earnest. I am very proud of how we all work together as a team, says Ibrahim. Cheers. Chapter 77. Joyce, I'm glad we told Chris and Donna about the bones. It seems right. Now everyone can keep an eye out. Who was here in the 1970s and is still here today? That should keep them all occupied for a bit. Everyone knows everything now, and that seems fair. So where are Johnny and Bobby? Now we've dealt with the bones, I know Elizabeth will be thinking about how we track them down. That's right up her street, isn't it? I will get a call in the morning and it will be, Joyce, we're going to Reading, or, Joyce, we're going to Inverness or Timbuktu, and bit by bit she'll tell me why, and before you know it we'll be having a cup of tea with Bobby Tanner, or a cafe au lait with Turkish Johnny. You wait and see. Tomorrow morning, before 10 a.m. Guaranteed. The only time I ever use my passport is when I need to pick up a parcel, but I've just checked and it has 3 years left. I remember when I first got it, wondering if it would be my last ever. The odds on it being renewed are with me now, I think. Anyway, that's just to say that if Johnny or Bobby Tanner are abroad somewhere, then I wouldn't put it past Elizabeth to hop on a plane. We're only a drive from Gatwick here. I could send Joanna a postcard.
Who, me?
Oh, I'm in Cyprus for a couple of days. Tracking down a fugitive. Possibly armed, but you mustn't worry. Though no one sends postcards anymore, do they? Joanna has shown me how to send photos on my phone, but I'm beggared if it's ever worked when I tried. I just get that spinning circle. Perhaps I could ask Bernard to come along with me. A couple of days in the sun? Last minute thing. We just fancied it. I think it might frighten the poor man to death. I don't like to give up on a chase, but Bernard seems to be drifting further and further away from me. He was not a bundle of fun at lunch, and there was plenty of steak and kidney left over. And don't think I don't know what the others think. What they suspect. They'll be checking whether Bernard was here 50 years ago. They haven't spoken to me about it, but you mark my words. Check away, don't mind me. Timbuktu is a real place, by the way. Did you know that? It came up in a quiz once. Ibrahim will remember where it is, but I did think that was interesting. Chapter 78. Chris Hudson is cradling a whiskey. He likes a real log fire, and they have a nice one in Le Pont Noir. He's never eaten here, because who would he eat with, but he likes the bar. The fire has a vintage tile surround, very tasteful. If you'd asked him 20 years ago, he would have imagined this was the sort of place he might live. Leather armchair, whiskey on the go, wife reading some sort of book opposite him. Something prize-winning and beyond him, but she'd be turning the pages, smiling wryly. A love story set against the backdrop of the Raj. He could be looking at murder case notes. Slowly solving something. He is still sure that Mackie is guilty as hell. It added up. But these bones. Did they change things? Had there been two murders, 50-odd years apart, one to protect the other? If so, then Mackie wasn't their man, they'd been through the records, he hadn't left Ireland until the 90s. His mind drifts back to his dream life. Were there kids sleeping upstairs? In new pajamas. A boy and a girl, 2 years apart. Good sleepers. But no, none of that. Just a fireplace in a bar that wasn't doing enough business, in a restaurant that he had no one to take to, Then a walk home, stop at the all-night shop for a dairy milk. A proper big one. Then the key fob, the apartment block, the three flights up, the flat that the cleaner kept clean, that no one ever cooked in, the spare room that was never used. If he opened his window he could hear the sea, but couldn't see it. Didn't that just sum it up? There was a life that Chris hadn't been able to take in his grasp. Families, driveways, trampolines, friends round for dinner, all the stuff you'd see on adverts. Was this forever now? The lonely flat with the neutral walls and the Sky Sports? Maybe there was a way out, but Chris couldn't immediately spot it. Treading water, getting fatter, laughing less. Chris was out of rocket fuel. It was lucky that Chris loved his job. Was good at his job. Chris always found it easy to get up in the morning. He just found it hard to go to sleep at night. Leave Mackie B for a minute and focus on Tony Curran's murder. Jason Ritchie had rung him earlier. Told his tale. Explained away the calls and the car. If he was lying, then he'd done a good job of it. But then he would, wouldn't he? Bobby Tanner was still proving elusive. After Amsterdam, there was no more Bobby Tanner on any official record. But he'd be somewhere. Maybe Brussels, living under some name or other, plenty of gangs could use him out there. He'd be doing what he'd always done. Smuggling, fighting, making himself useful. Not a big enough fish for anyone to worry about. Burned often enough to be careful. They'd catch him coming out of some expat gym one day, put their hand on his shoulder and fly him back for a few questions. Though, of course, there was a good chance that Bobby Tanner was dead too. Steroids, pub fight, fell off a ferry, so many ways to go and the only way to identify him a false passport. But Chris thinks Bobby is still out there somewhere, and if he's still out there somewhere, then who's to say he hadn't just paid a visit to Tony Curran for some long-forgotten reason? Something to do with his brother drowning with that boat full of drugs. Who knew? And then the new name, Turkish Johnny. Chris had found plenty on record for him. Johnny Gundas was his real name. Fled the country in the early 2000s after a tip-off he'd murdered the cabbie in the Black Bridge shooting. Everything kept coming back to that one night. In this very bar. Had Johnny come back to town? Chris finishes his whiskey and looks at the tiles once again. Beautiful really. He should probably go home. Chapter 79. Joyce, just two quick things this morning, as I find myself in a hurry. Firstly, Timbuktu is in Mali. I bumped into Ibrahim on my way back from the post box and I asked him. I also saw Bernard walking, slowly, up the hill. It's every day now, but never mind. And, as I say, Mali. So now you know. Secondly, Elizabeth rang at 9:17 and we're off to Folkestone. From the looks of it, it's two changes, one at St. Leonard's and one at Ashford International, so we're setting off nice and early. I haven't been to Ashford International, but I doubt a station would have International in its name and not have an M&S. Maybe even an Oliver Bonus. Fingers crossed. I promise I will report back later. Chapter 80. In many ways, his neighbors owed Peter Ward a debt of thanks and, to be fair, most of them knew it. Pearson Street had always been a little down at heel. A newsagent with no papers, a mini-mart, with a mountain of cheap alcohol behind the counter, a travel agent with fading posters of the sun, two bookies, a pub on its last legs, a party accessories shop, a nail bar and a boarded-up cafe. And then the flour mill had moved in. Peter Ward's shop, bursting with color, a little rainbow explosion on this gray street. And what flowers? Peter Ward knew his stuff, and when you know your stuff in a small town, word soon gets around. People would start making detours from the town center. And they would tell their friends, who would tell their friends and, before you know it, someone down from London has spotted the boarded-up cafe and bought the lease and now there were two reasons to visit Pearson Street. Then a bride ordering flowers from Peter and enjoying a latte in the cafe, sees this little street is on the up and wonders if it might be the place to open a small hardware store? So now the tool chest sits next to the flour mill, opposite Casa Cafe. The travel agent suddenly has people walking past, feels the need to change those posters and those people start walking in. Under 30s mainly, who have no idea what a travel agent might be. The Londoner with the cafe buys the pub and starts doing food. Terry at the news agent starts ordering in more papers, more milk, more everything. The nail bar paints more nails, the party shop sells more balloons, the mini mart starts stocking gin alongside the vodka. John from the butcher's counter at Asda takes the leap and opens a store of his own, taking his customers with him. A local art group hires out a vacant storefront and takes it in turns to buy pieces of each other's art. All thanks to Peter Ward's orchids and sweet peas and Transvaal daisies. Pearson Street is just what you want a shopping street to be. Busy, friendly, local and happy. Joyce thinks it's so perfect, that it's surely only 6 months away from having a Costa and losing what it now has. Which would be sad, but Joyce has to admit that she likes a Costa, so must shoulder some of the blame. Joyce and Elizabeth are sitting in Casa Cafe. Peter Ward has just bought them both a cappuccino. Becky from the tool chest will keep an eye out for customers while he takes half an hour off. It's that sort of street. Peter Ward is graying and smiling and has the easy air of a man who has made a series of good decisions in life. A Folkestone florist, whom karma has rewarded for a lifetime of kindness and calmness, a man whose good deeds have delivered him the prize of happiness. This impression is misleading. As the scar under his right eye and the bulge of the biceps will tell you, Peter Ward is Bobby Tanner. Or perhaps Peter Ward has left Bobby Tanner behind. That is what they have come to find out. Is the fighter still there? The killer perhaps? Has he recently made the short trip along the coast to Fairhaven and bludgeoned to death his former boss? Elizabeth lays the photograph on the table between them and Peter Ward picks it up, smiling. The Black Bridge, says Peter. We had a few nights in there. Where'd you get this from? A number of places, says Elizabeth. Well, two places, in fact. One was sent to Jason Ritchie and one was found by the corpse of Tony Curran. I read about Tony, nods Peter Ward. That was about time. You've never seen this photograph before, asks Elizabeth. Peter looks again, then says, never have. You weren't sent one, asks Joyce, and sips her cappuccino. Peter shakes his head. Well, that's either good news for you, or it's good news for us, says Elizabeth. Peter Ward raises an inquiring eyebrow. Well, it's either good news for you, in that Tony Curran's killer has no idea where you are. Or it's good news for us, in that you killed Tony Curran yourself and we haven't wasted a trip to Folkestone. Peter Ward gives a half smile and looks at the photo again. Not that the trip would really be wasted, says Joyce. We're having a very nice day. The police have the idea that Jason killed Tony Curran, starts Elizabeth. And perhaps he did. But, for reasons of our own, we would prefer that he didn't. Would you have a view on that, Bobby? Peter Ward holds up a hand. Peter around here, please. Would you have a view on that, Peter, asks Elizabeth. I don't see it, says Peter Ward. Jason went nowhere near that side of things. He looks mean, but he's a teddy bear. Joyce looks up from her notes for a moment. A teddy bear who funded a major drugs ring. Peter acknowledges this with a nod. Elizabeth puts the photo back down on the table. So, if not Jason, then perhaps you? Or perhaps Turkish Johnny. Turkish Johnny, says Peter. He took the photo. Peter Ward thinks for a while. Did he now? I don't remember, but that would make sense. I'm guessing you know the story? The boy Tony shot in the Black Bridge? Johnny shooting the taxi driver who got rid of the body. We know that story, yes, confirms Elizabeth. Then Johnny disappears back to Cyprus.
Well, it wasn't quite that simple, says Peter Ward.
I'm all ears, says Elizabeth.
Someone grossed Johnny up to the cops.
They raided his flat, but he'd gone already.
And who grossed him up, asks Elizabeth.
Who knows?
Not me.
No one likes a grass, says Joyce.
It doesn't matter who, says Peter Ward.
What matters is that when Johnny legged it, he took $100,000 of Tony's cash with him.
Is that so?
Money he had lying around his flat?
Tony's money.
All disappeared.
Tony went mental.
$100,000 was a lot of money to Tony in those days.
Did he try and find Johnny? Asks Elizabeth.
You bet.
Went off to Cyprus a couple of times.
Didn't find a thing.
Not easy when it's not your natural territory, says Elizabeth.
So I'm guessing you haven't found Johnny either, asks Peter Ward.
Elizabeth shakes her head.
How did you find me, by the way, he goes on.
If you don't mind me asking?
I don't really want to be found by anyone if Gianni's back in town, leaving photos of me next to bodies.
Elizabeth takes a sip of her coffee.
Woodvale Cemetery, where they buried your brother Troy.
Peter Ward nods.
I got access to the CCTV, thanks to a mortician whose uncle I once saved on a train, says Elizabeth.
That's where I found you.
Peter Ward looks at Elizabeth.
Elizabeth, I've been there twice in a year.
There's no way you found me from the CCTV.
That'd be a needle in a haystack.
You went there twice,
yes, agrees Elizabeth.
But on what days?
Peter Ward sits back, folds his arms, then nods and smiles.
He sees it now.
12th of March and 17th of September, continues Elizabeth.
Troy's birthday and the anniversary of his death.
I was hoping to see the same car both times, jot down a number plate, get the friend of a friend to run it through a computer somewhere. But on March the 12th I saw a white van from a Folkestone flower shop, which I thought unusual at a cemetery in Brighton.
Not impossible, but noteworthy.
And I thought it very, very unusual to see the same van on September the 17th.
I found that very noteworthy indeed.
You see?
I do see, nods Peter Ward.
And no need for a number plate.
Because you had your name, your address, and your telephone number sign written on the side, says Elizabeth.
Peter can't help but give Elizabeth a quiet round of applause and she responds with a slight bow.
That's very good, Elizabeth, says Joyce.
She's very good, Peter.
I see that, says Peter.
So no one else knows where I am.
No one else can find me.
Not unless I tell them where you are, says Elizabeth.
Peter Ward leans forward.
And is that something you'd be likely to do?
Elizabeth leans forward too.
Not if you come and see us tomorrow, sit down with Jason and the police and tell them what you just told us.